So can you just introduce yourself?
Okay, my name is Dave Huber. I currently reside in Sooke, BC. I have retired from the Armed Forces back in March of 2004, and I spent approximately 23 years in the regular force as a medical assistant, working in with various units in various locations of Canada.
So where were you born, and what was your earliest experience with the military?
I was born in Winnipeg, Manitoba, grew up in Saskatoon, Saskatchewan. And my experience with the military is I had a grandfather that served in the Second World War. And there's little chit-chat about that in our family and whatnot, and everybody kind of thought that that was kind of a neat contribution. So at about the ages of 15, I found myself in Army Cadets. Found that I had a knack for that. And then that just evolved into working in the reserve forces, and I did that throughout high school until upon graduation of high school, rolled over into the regular force.
So where was your first set of training?
First set of training that I did was basic training, and that was in Cornwallis, Nova Scotia. That's a 2 month. It was 2 months long at that point in time, and that's where the Navy did all of their recruit training or whatnot before integration into the tri-services.
So what unit was that for?
That was just for Canadian Armed Forces. That was recruit training school.
Okay, just the basic, yeah. Basic.
That's basic, basic. Let's get more basic than that.
Yeah. So what was your training? It was like just after that, after basic, what would you do?
After basic, we were all sent to our different trades training schools. If you were a non-combat arm, chances are that you ended up going to Borden, Ontario, which is where I went for my medical trades training. I did my TQ3 training there in 1983, and that was 15 weeks of formalized classroom training, 6 weeks of hospital training, and then 18 months of on-the-job training in the unit to which you were posted. And for me, I was posted to Moose Jaw, Saskatchewan for the first 3 years.
Okay. And I guess after that, where did you end up?
After Moose Jaw, I was posted to 2 field ambulance, 1 airborne evac platoon, and CFB Petawawa. That was part of the Special Service Force. That would have been in 87. Every unit in that brigade had an airborne component of it of some kind. And naturally, before going on to the airborne regiment, that was sent to an airborne or to a field ambulance airborne evac platoon, which is where you start to sharpen your teeth as far as the airborne group goes.
Yeah. And how was that different from other training you've done?
It was vastly different from other training I'd done. It was field training again, which I hadn't done since I was with the reserve forces, so I was glad to be doing that. And because we had what was called the CAS Brigade Group at that time, which is the Canadian Air Sea Transportable Brigade Group, from time to time found ourselves on little notice, usually at least once or twice a year, in Norway.
Yeah.
So we'd be given a little bug-out exercise or whatnot to go fight these phantom Russian armies or whatnot as an exercise with other nations, and we'd end up in northern Norway, which was actually quite a blast. We'd end up there for about 6 weeks at a time, training with other NATO nations. In various roles, where the majority of which was mountain operations for the most part.
So you did a lot of jumping then, or?
Not in that phase, not there. When we got back to Canada, we would do a little bit more parachute training. I did my jump course before I got to Petawawa. As part of the Airborne Evac Platoon, what we did is we supported the Airborne Regiment when they required extra medical assistant. A perfect example of that was operations in northern Canada.
Mm-hmm.
First time I jumped with the Airborne Regiment, it was in support of 3 Commando on Baffin Island in a place called Cape Dorset. We jumped into that frozen basin in January, February. Oof. I can't remember when it was, 86, 87, something like that. It was cold. It was very cold.
What kind of supplies were you jumping with, like mostly medical or?
You jump with all your personal equipment, winter, full Arctic rucksack. Then you also have the luxury of being a medical assistant. You always jump, well, you work with headquarters, so I always jumped a belt of ammo, an extra battery for the radio, and my medical bag, which would weigh about another 30 pounds. So you always had the joy of taking some extra equipment with you out the plane.
Sure, that was fun.
Hard landings.
Yeah.
Hard landings.
So I guess from there, where were you headed after Maryland?
Yeah, from there I went right to the Airborne Regiment. They were having a big changeover at that time. It was just the demographics of the people were moving around throughout the trade, so it was great. I went over there the same year as two other guys that I'd worked with in the Airborne Evac Platoon did, so it was great. So I already knew people there, they already knew me, so it was a pretty seamless transition into that organization, into that unit. And the medical branch being what it is, you basically know just about everybody anywhere anyway, yep. So... word of mouth is somebody's coming to your unit, and either it's a yay or nay thing, so it was always a good thing for myself. I was always welcomed into almost every unit I went to.
That's good. I guess with your medical training, were you any specialized medical training, or was it just...
It was mostly advanced field stuff, primary care stuff, pre-hospital, mm-hmm. Securing airways, replacing fluids, big wounds.
Yeah.
Immobilizing bodies, packaging bodies up for transport, and I mean body and casualties, whether it be in a mountain operations, whether it be in the Arctic, mm-hmm. Those types of situations, getting people ready to be transported by helicopter if required, how to properly bandage or package them up for that. So it was a lot of pointing into the bayonet stuff for the most part.
Did you ever do any of the jungle training, like the extreme heat situations, or...
Jungle training? No, I didn't get into jungle training. That was, every commando had its own forte.
Yep.
Three commando was very attuned to mountain operations. Mm-hmm. Two commando was for desert operations. And one commando was very good for the jungle aspect. Every September, back in the 80s, one commando would take approximately 30 guys. They take a few medics and they go down to French Guiana, mm-hmm. and they do the French Foreign Legion Jungle Warfare course there. And they would finish their course training down there, I think it was 6 or 8 weeks long, with a live fire border patrol. So they'd actually go out and do a patrol with the Foreign Legion at the end of it. But that was one commando thing. That was.
So for the most part, then you work with three commando?
Two commando was the one that I ended up going to. I started with three commando because in 85, the Airborne Regiment was just coming back from a tour in Cyprus.
Yep.
And that's when I got sent to the Airborne Regiment. It was around that time. And so they were in Cyprus. I was posted to the real unit, the rear guard unit. And the majority of those people were three commando. That's why I ended up going up north. Once the commando returned, was on the ground, consolidated after the mission to Cyprus, after the posting rotation, I was sent right to two commando.
Okay.
Which is basically PPCLIs.
Yeah, a lot of West Coast guys.
Yep. Yeah, and that's where I spend most of my time with them.
I get from there, where did you...
Okay. Did a few years in the Airborne Regiment.
I guess another question too here. What was your reasons for signing up for the Airborne over another regiment?
Well, it was the best unit in Canada.
Yep.
It offered everything that one was to expect that soldiering was supposed to be about.
So it was the best for the best mentality?
Yeah, exactly. They did everything. Mountains, Arctic, jungle, desert, mm-hmm. different ranges, unarmed combat. You did the whole nine yards, which was kind of appealing.
Yeah, for sure. So, sorry, I interrupted. No. But yeah, where did you go after then, after they got back from Cyprus?
After back from Cyprus, it was a training cycle, so it was just training up the guys in their individual weapon techniques, small exercises here and there. Our job was to provide medical support for all those. Mm-hmm. So a couple of times I'd find myself out. Example would be the patrol pathfinder course, airborne recce course. Doing support for them as far as mountain operations, that was one of the ones that I ended up doing. Was supporting them for that. That was kind of a good goal. There's various weapons training, whether it be TOW missile training. They did have that capability in the Airborne Regiment. It wasn't a large one. There was a mortar platoon. Again, they had that capability. It wasn't large. Individual weapons. And that was it for most of that training cycle when I was with the Airborne Regiment. A lot of it was operations. And exercises in the north and independent locations across Canada doing different little raids and stuff like that.
I guess being in the medical field too, were there any injuries that were kind of prominent in the airborne, like
legs or back? Oh yeah. Unlike a lot of dry exercises where you get the odd little person that gets a little burn from a pyrotechnic or whatnot, the airborne regiment had that luxury of when you jump with your med bag, you jump with all your kit. The boys may be on exercise, but you're jumping all your drugs and all your kit because somebody's going to go boom.
Yeah.
And parachute training being parachute training, there's always injuries. Pulling guys out of trees on the Battle River in Wainwright, be good for a giggle. I remember once actually having to take and send the commanding officer of 2 Commando, at the time Major Kenward,
yeah,
later to become Colonel Kenward, off the drop zone with a pretty nasty break on a hard landing. He wasn't very fond about going off the drop zone on that one, but it was good enough that he was not humping with us for the rest of that exercise.
Yeah.
Broken ankles. We had one really bad accident in Petawawa. We'll call him Trapper John. Everybody that knows him knows who I'm talking about. Had a junior parachute shoot his steal his air at 200 feet, and he actually Roman candled in from about 200 feet.
Sorry, what's that expression? Roman candled?
Roman candled. His chute collapsed, and it just went into a big yeah, floppy rag at about 200 feet, and he hammered in pretty hard. He bounced.
Yeah.
He bounced. And he was in pins and needles for about the next 2.5 years. So he was banged up pretty good. I've helped people off the drop zone that walked off with a broken back.
Yeah.
Put their parachute down and go, okay, my back is sore, and we get them in, get them x-rayed. Sure enough, and walked off drop zone with broken backs.
Yeah.
So you see stuff.
And this is just in the training, too, not even that.
Just training. It's just people land hard. Wind blows a little bit more than it's supposed to. Equipment gets in the way.
Yeah. So I guess after the training with these, what was your next step?
Let's see here. There was more medical training in Borden for 6 months. And then from there, I ended up, I was with the Airborne Regiment when we got tasked to provide support for United Nations mission. They were really short on medical staff, so they actually came to the Airborne Regiment and took three of us went from the Airborne Regiment to Iran, Iraq at the end of the hostilities between those two nations back in 88.
Mm-hmm.
So three of us went to southwestern Iran.
So when you were there, was it like a military hospital, or were you more civilian?
Oh, no, we were on our own. We were just providing medical support for the communication troops that we were in support of. The mission for that particular operation was cessation of hostilities was going to be signed. They needed communications along the whole border between Iran and Iraq, 1,200-mile border. They needed something in there right away so that military observers would be able to talk back and forth along the whole length of the border. So Canada was tasked to provide that communication link. So all these signalers and all these jimmies, as they call them, were sent on the ground with their little Kratz vans with all their secure uplink satellite communication stuff, and we were there to support them medically for a few things. One being it was a desert environment. We got there in August through September to December. The average temperature was about 55 degrees Celsius. You couldn't handle your vehicles without gloves, without burning yourself. We were consuming up to 12 liters of water per man per day. So medically, it was a bit of a demanding thing. You had to make sure people topped up on fluids. You had to make sure that they weren't sleeping where all the scorpions were. Watch out for sand fleas, amoebic dysentery, giardiasis, a whole bunch of other diseases that are incumbent to there. So that was a busy one. Plus the fact that cessation of hostilities was in New York, but it wasn't on the ground. There were approximately 4 fatalities a day in our sector alone the entire time we were there. We were only there to cover 200 miles of frontage. So it was hopping, it was busy, and it wasn't fun.
Yeah. Were that a lot of combat casualties or medical casualties kind of thing?
They were all Iranian and Iraqi casualties.
Yeah.
They were mortaring each other. They were doing whatever. We had to go help them out on one mine clearing accident. But for the most part, it was their concern. The tertiary concern of ours, and some people ended up did get sent back because of it, was they had to trial a new piece of equipment that we got to take out there, which was good, which was the CAMS, which is a it's a chemical analyzing monitor system.
Yeah.
Little hand sniffing thing that they use every day now. In almost every airport you can see them now for all this NBCW nuclear biological stuff. They were brand new when we were using them.
Yeah.
And there's a reason for it too, because there's still a lot of dust mustard agents being used where we were.
Yeah.
The Iraqis were not too shy about throwing that stuff around in any still water or anything like that, so we had to be careful about that. Sure enough, a few guys ended up did swimming in a little pond, ended up did getting quite a bit of some pretty nasty mustard burns.
Yeah, I can imagine.
So yeah, that was busy. After that tour, my contract with CF was coming to a close. I had a couple of really bad days on the ground in Iran. It involved mine clearing involving the deaths of a few kids.
Yeah.
The Iranians had this habit of using children for tools.
Yeah.
So came back to Canada, wasn't too quick to re-sign on after that. That was when we had a really particularly bad week in the Canadian Airborne Regiment, casualty-wise.
Whereabouts, I guess?
Yeah. It was in January of 89, everybody had just come back off Christmas leave. Mm-hmm. I had just come back off my leave from Iran. I was still quite sick. Just about everybody came back with something. I think I came back with giardiasis. I think I'd lost 35 pounds. So a lot of us were just trying to get ourselves back into shape coming off of leave.
Lots of turkey.
Lots of turkey, lots of beer for the boys.
Yeah.
And we had this big national exercise going up in Fort Wainwright, Alaska. And we were doing our staging as an airborne battle group does. We flew everybody from Trenton. Everybody was quick reading to Trenton. Trenton, just fly everything out to Edmonton, do a commando or a regimental consolidation in Edmonton, fly up, airland an air landing party for headquarters, and then boom, the whole regiment was jumping in to work with the American Airborne up there in Fort Wainwright. Problems occurred. Well, the first incident was we were supposed to, the advance party was going to be on the ground on Sunday the 31st or 29th, 30th. Anyway, that Thursday, five guys from 2 Commando got killed on their way back from Eganville in a car crash. Somebody was drunk driving or whatnot, so that wrote off five guys from 2 Commando. So 2 Commando was, at that point, pulled out of the exercise because they were going to be doing funerals. Sunday, that was on Thursday, Sunday, the air landing party went in, and it was the first Hercules to go in, landed, second Hercules to went in, crashed. Nine fatalities on that one, of which we lost our warrant officer from the medical platoon. Keith Arsenal was killed on that one. So it was a personal loss for us. And that began the exercise right there. They said that was it. We've got enough casualties right now. They indexed it right there.
Yeah.
Airborne Regiment came back to Edmonton, back to Petawawa, and that, like I said, I didn't renew my contract at that point. So I spent the last 14 days doing 11 funerals.
In
February. No. So I let my contract expire. I went back to Saskatoon. Ended up working with reserves. Mm-hmm. Doing medical infantry stuff again.
Training new guys or just
reservists? Just light training for reserves. Did that for a year, and then after about a year, decided it was time to get back into it again. So called up my boss in Petawawa. Said, listen, I'd like to come back to the Airborne Regiment. The messages already been sent because I called in June. So I ended up going with Patricia's again.
Yep.
And I ended up going to 2 PPCLI in Winnipeg. And it was just timing that most of the people that I had worked with in 2 Commando just happened to be sent to 2 PPCLI in Winnipeg when I got there. So it was tit for tat. Everybody knew everybody, which was good.
Another good fit in.
Yeah. Just a different role as far as training goes. They were more of a mechanized thing.
Yeah.
Mechanized infantry role, so that was all new stuff to me.
Interesting as well, or not quite?
It was interesting. It was total different type of warfare. It was the stuff that they always trained for in Europe.
Yep.
You were riding around on the APCs, the Army Personnel Carriers, and getting out doing dismounted attacks, mounted attacks and stuff. And that's all new stuff to me.
Yeah.
I'd never done that stuff before. So there's a bit of a learning curve, and I found it frustrating, I'll admit, first exercise out, first few weeks out. Because I was used to, the biggest heat signature I had was a rucksack on my back. And all of a sudden I got 14 tons of steel wrapped around me.
Yeah.
I was supposed to crew command. Okay. Yeah. So there's a bit of a learning curve there, but the guys actually made it a pretty easy curve, actually. The troops were pretty good. I had no problems with them at all. Well, I've always had a good go with the Patricias.
Yeah. I guess compared to airborne, though, was it more fun, I guess less fun, or difficult, easier?
It was totally different. It was a different type of warfare. It was not, if I had to pick and choose what I'd rather be doing, I'd rather be back with the airborne regiment.
Mm-hmm.
It was just more what I would consider more serious soldiering than what you do in the APCs.
Yeah.
You sit around getting fat, eating rations, and not doing a whole lot in the APCs. Get out, run around for a couple hundred meters, run back, and then pound yourself on the chest, go, yeah, I'm a good soldier. Whatever.
Not so much.
Yeah. But no, it was total different soldiering. Totally different.
So then from the second, or Princess Patricia's, where did you go next?
From the PPCLI, I went to base hospital in Winnipeg.
Yep.
Time to get out of the field.
Yep.
Get some dirt off the boots, as they say. They like to do that in our trade. You know, they don't want to leave you living under a rucksack for your entire career. So they rotate us around. So I ended up going to the base hospital. Spent very little time working on the wards. Ended up running the treatment room. Managing that there for a few years after that. And then from Winnipeg, it was off to, missed Somalia, missed Uganda, not Somalia, missed Uganda, missed Rwanda, Victoria. Yeah, ended up in Victoria, the base hospital again.
Whereabouts in Victoria?
In Esquimalt, CP Esquimalt. Worked at the base hospital, wasn't even there a year, went on trades training for another 6 months of medical training in Borden. Came back from that, got sent on a ship, which is what the med services do, is they get you on all three. So I ended up going to HMCS Protector. I was on board that ship for about 10 days when we got our orders to go to pack up and take off to East Timor.
Mm-hmm.
So that was a quick turnaround. So having thought that it was difficult to soldier in an APC, all of a sudden I've got 250,000 tons of steel wrapped around me, and we're doing this Navy stuff, which is
way bigger heat sink.
Oh man, I am not a sailor. It was a good go, and the fact that those boys have no idea how good they have it.
Yeah.
It was a very unique operational experience doing East Timor on a boat. I'll tell you, that was totally checked out. And it was kind of ironic that we did get on the ground into East Timor, and the Van Dues ended up going into Suwai, which is where they were located on the southern central East Timor. So we'd always sail around between there and Dili, which is in north central, so we'd end up swimming around the island. We'd be up north and we'd be doing RAS, or replenishment at sea, so you're driving along in the boat and you hook up with another one, you pull the line across and you do fuel and food and people and all that stuff. We do that with all the other coalition navies that were doing this, and then we go down to the south and we'd actually get off the boat and go out and do some work and support the Van Dues that were on the ground. And it just so happened that, I don't know, it must have been at least half a dozen of those guys I recognized from one commando.
Yeah.
So the boys are still around. They're just wearing different uniforms at that time. So I spent a year on the boat, and I ended up getting promoted off the boat. They don't have sergeant medes at sea, so I got promoted off of that, went back to the base hospital, to the training section. I was going to be the training NCO IC in charge of it.
Sorry, this is back in Victoria?
In Victoria, sorry, yeah. And at that point I was given the extra little lovely choice or job of standing up the operations, the medical operations and training section, which was a bit of work considering that the timeline was September 11th happened. I was on the ground 6 months in operations and training operations being the new thing that we were just standing up. Then the September 11th thing happened, and then medical operations got real busy when the boys went in. We had a ship leave for Afghanistan by November, December. The HMCS Ottawa slipped and was gone that quick, so we had to stand up that boat medically. And then Patricia's were on the ground. One was Tora Bora. For that spring, they were on the ground probably a long time before then. So it was getting busy.
Yeah. So I guess as far as your training after the airborne, do you think it helped you at all? Like the kind of the intense training with the airborne, or you think it changed the way you would have looked at things, or?
Leaps and bounds above everything. The airborne regiment requires you to be a thinking soldier, which is good. You have to think your way through problems. You have to problem solve your own personal inadequacies. You have to mentally get through whatever fog you're in or whatnot, depending upon a situation. You have to be able to improvise. You know, all good traits, and it's trained up piecemeal. Like, you start by doing really simple exercises where there's not a lot required of you personally, and you work your way up to the point where, okay, everything's just gone for shit. You're on your own, and this still has to be done.
Yeah.
You know, and, you know, you work through the mental tools that you have and whatever you have with you to still be able to get together with as enough people that you can to try to do the job that has to be done. And I'll tell you, no other unit that I've ever seen, foreign or domestic, trains for that capability.
Yeah.
The American Special Forces do to a certain degree. The boys in Delta, that's a total different mission scope. The SAS are pretty good at doing that. When they do their jungle training, they work on that a lot in Borneo. The guys in Harrowford are doing black stuff, so you don't see a whole lot of initiative on that. But the airborne regiment being green that it was, we weren't wearing any black stuff. It was good stuff that you had to learn, and you learned it up front. You started with the airborne and doc course when you first get to Petawawa. Nasty or dirty 10-day course. It used to be a 6-week course when the airborne regiment first started in Edmonton. Petawawa, they knocked it down quite a bit. So it's 10 days of bark eating 101. And they put the stress on you. And it's good. And then as you go on through the airborne regiment, you pick up more tools, you pick up more tools, you pick up more tools. You're working in a regimental environment which is unlike any other in the armed forces. You have your own group of medics, you have your own group of signalers, you have your own group of gunners, you have your own group of driver. Everything is self-contained. So everybody knows everybody. Everybody basically knows everybody other's capabilities, and you're invited to participate in other training.
Yeah.
Which is cool.
Did anybody ever, I guess probably people did, but is anyone that dropped out because of stress, or like, was that common, or?
It was very rare.
Yeah.
Very, very, very rare. You usually lost most people to jump school.
Yeah, to injuries.
Jump school,
way.
You know, if not even injuries, I'm talking, you lose people at the mock tower.
Yeah, so
you know, psychological thing. You know, that was the biggest thing, was a psychological fear. How do you get over your fear? That's the first thing you learn in the airborne regiment, is how to command that fear thing. I personally only ever saw one man lose it in the aircraft, and he lost it. He was a weapons tech. Mm-hmm. He's a Franco guy. Came to service commando. He was probably there. Oh, he wasn't with us for 3 months, I don't think. And his first full equipment night drop, he freaked out in the aircraft. He was in the middle of the stick, and he started yelling and screaming and stuff, and they had to unhook him.
Yeah.
They had to physically pull him out of the rack of the guys, move him to the forward part of the bulkhead of the aircraft, sit him down, strapped him in with a seatbelt, got pointed at, "You will not jump," by the jump master, and then they went through and got the rest of us out.
Yeah.
That was disconcerting to see that, actually. That scared a few people. It spooked us. We'd never seen that before.
Yeah.
Never seen somebody actually crack. And he did. He cracked. We never saw him again. The aircraft landed. He was summarily posted out of the airborne regiment while we were on exercise. Never saw him after that. It was that quick. And it was good that they did that.
You don't want to spook the guys.
Exactly. You don't want people thinking too much about it. Yeah. You just want people to do it. But it was good training. You got to do everything. Medics I've worked with, one of them, Jim Prevo, went on to be a mountain operations instructor. Mm-hmm. Instructor. Medic. Another friend of mine, Dave Marshall, who's posted out here right now, he's still in the Armed Forces. Parachute instructor. Medic. Mm-hmm. Me, I got to go out with two commando do their unarmed combat courses, which was a blast, and jab slapping people all over the place. What other courses? We free fall parachutists, medics, patrol pathfinder, medics. Mm-hmm. You know, we were doing everything that every pointy bayonet on the ground was doing, which is unheard of in other units.
Yeah, usually want to keep medics kind of a little bit safer out of the way.
Well, usually they figure the medic's the guy is reading a novel in the ambulance back at the gates, you know, at the back of the range.
Yeah.
Not an airborne regiment.
No, you're
just another bayonet until somebody gets hurt.
Yeah.
Which was good, because you learned how to patrol. You learned all the guys. The stuff that they're doing in Afghanistan right now is the stuff that we did in the Airborne Regiment. Medics were that far forward. Mm-hmm. That's why you're seeing a lot of medics going down right now. But.
Yeah, I mean.
Mm-hmm. Enough said there.
So you definitely recommend that experience to other people? Like, if it was still available?
It was a lost cause. Well, it's coming back now.
Yeah.
CSOR is on the ground now. Canadian Special Ops Regiment is going to be filling a bit of that. It's their mission roles evolving.
Mm-hmm.
Their equipment tables is evolving. Their mandate is evolving. It's a very fluid period as far as special operations in the Armed Forces right now. I jumped with the commanding officer of that unit. I've worked with in two commando. The RSM of that unit right now, Eric Scheidel. And they're going through a lot of changes, but it's good changes. We almost lost that niche.
Yeah.
With the Airborne Regiment, when the Airborne Regiment got stood down, we almost lost that capability. Very, very, very close to losing that capability. That would have been really expensive and hard to get back.
Yeah.
But there's still a few guys on the ground that served with commando that can bring that stuff back to the forefront. Get the troops sharpened up a little bit. And it's coming back. It's going to be called something else, but it's coming back.
Yeah. So, yeah, I guess the next question is a question about the Somalia stuff. Do you feel comfortable?
Somalia? Oh, you want to know about that. I wasn't there, but I can tell you all about
how you felt about the after effect.
The trial? Yeah. Or the... all that whole affair. Well, put it this way. Kyle was a nice kid.
Yeah.
You know, he's eager to please. He got misguided, matchy, piece of shit. Arrogant, mouthy guy. Yeah, he could do some physical stuff or whatnot, but he wouldn't have lasted long in the Airborne Regiment. His days were numbered when he got there. The troops tend to police their own. I can tell you about another episode, and ended up sending four guys to Edmonton.
Yeah.
And we call it, what do we call it? The Night of the Four Horsemen. Anyway, that's something else. That's the troops policing themselves, and the troops do that. Somalia, political convenience,
yeah,
for lack of a better word. You know, it was political convenience. There has always been people in DHQ that did not like the Airborne Regiment, did not like the elitism as far as the way that they looked at themselves and their mission role, did not like the favors that were given to the Airborne Regiment because of their unique mission role, which is defense of Canada,
yeah,
not Somalia, not Yugoslavia.
We train the Arctic.
Defense of Canada. So there was always guns looking for the Airborne Regiment from its inception, from Rochester right on up, boom, as soon as it got stood up. Somalia itself, sorry?
Sorry, just do you feel discipline was a problem sometimes in the Airborne with them being kind of elitist?
In the 80s, it was starting to become a bit of an issue with the fact of training cycles did not match, and that's important.
Mm-hmm.
It's really important. That goes with building up that esprit de corps. is that you train as a unit and you progress and you evolve and you move on as a unit. If you don't, then you're going to have disjointed, you're going to have overlapping levels of experience, aggression, all that stuff. And that's what the Airborne Regiment fell into, is that they were quick to post out their officers because their officers came in, get stamped, yes, I did the Airborne Regiment time, and would take off as quick as they could.
Yeah.
Which left a lot of warrant officers and sergeants playing mom and dad and doing the officer thing, and then when the officer showed up and tried to say stuff, they'd say, no, you're wrong, and blah, blah. So there were discipline problems then.
Yeah.
And that's why. You had various levels of training, and same thing the other way around, too. You had troops that were in there as privates or troopers and corporals and master corporals, and they're getting new sergeants and warrants that don't know what they're doing. The kids take over.
Yeah.
The kids know the job. It's hard for discipline. A guy from One Can Pair put it best. You know, the troops in the Airborne Regiment are just like they were in One Can Para. They're like a pack of huskies. And they need firm, hard leadership all the time, or they will start eating each other, or they will start eating you. And that's probably one of the best analogies that I've ever heard. And it's true. You know, they need a firm grip. We were the best in the field, and the worst discipline problems in barracks.
Yeah.
Oh. Yes.
Fun stuff behind cool
work doors. Hard, play hard.
Yeah.
That would happen. Again, you're going to get that with any guys. You don't wind people up, yell, kill, kill, kill all day, and then turn it off at 4:30. It doesn't work that way. You're going to have your problems, but what unit doesn't?
Yeah. Some more so than others.
Yeah. Somalia wasn't good, though. Somalia was just political expediency. Yeah. It was a bad tour. It was a tour that it was an illegal tour, number one.
Yeah.
It was a legal rotation. It was a rotation. The Airborne Regiment wanted to do something. They were just stood down for Western Sahara. They needed to do something operational. Last time they'd done something was Cyprus in 85. Mm-hmm. So the boys were chomping at the bit to do something. But that's not their mission role. Mm-hmm. You know, they're not to run around the world, save the world. That's not their job. And that's what they weren't trained for. And then when they tried to do the workups for Somalia, that's why the regiment started to come apart. That's when you had your command and control problems with the CO.
Yeah.
And people should take another close look at the brigade commander at the time, too. There's some political agenda there, which not a lot of people talk about with Bino. General Bino, I should say. It was all political at that point. Airborne Regiment went for the wrong reason. They had problems on the ground. Pretty trivial in comparison to what else was going on the ground. And I don't want to say that it's approved some of the stuff that went down, beating prisoners or whatnot. You don't beat them to death.
No.
You don't beat them if you can avoid it. But you take a look at what the Italians were doing, what the Americans were doing. They were killing people left, right, and center. And I don't want to use that as an excuse or anything like that, but to disband an entire regiment over the discipline problems of a few.
It doesn't make any sense.
Yeah. It's just political expediency. Just wanted to get rid of it. Yeah. And the time was ripe.
Yeah. So what were your reasons for finally leaving the military? Just kind of shift gears.
No, it's... Well, actually, it was two. It was medical first. It was medical reasons I had to leave the CF. I had stamped on the forehead with PTSD. Post-traumatic stress disorder, and they said that was undiagnosed from Iran.
Yeah.
So that was a big one. And I got a bad neck, a couple of hard landings myself.
I can imagine. Everyone
I walked away from one, and one I didn't walk away from. So those were the primary ones. And it was time to move on too. Near the end of my service in the medical branch, I could already see the different type of troops that were coming in on the ground.
Mm-hmm.
It's a different soldier today than what we had when I joined. Kids are a lot more, what's the word I'm looking for? Serious and sober, I guess you would say. There's a lot more professionalism than people are giving the troops or the kids credit for nowadays. The demands made upon them on today's battlefield is quite a bit much more than it was when I was on the ground.
So you're saying when you joined it wasn't that serious? Or I mean, like, it was still serious?
Oh, it was still serious, yeah. But it's a different type of soil. It's a different type of environment. It's a different type of training that they're doing. It's a different world out there.
Yeah.
And things just evolved. Yeah, we might have looked nice and shiny and modern in the 80s to what the guys did in the 60s. But come on, it's now year 2010 or whatever coming up, and stuff that we did in the 80s is pretty antiquated compared to the stuff that the guys are doing nowadays with, yeah, with the equipment that they have, and the demands of the battlefield have been rising exponentially since the Second World War. Mm-hmm. So the days of the thick, dumb infantier are gone.
Yeah.
They are gone. I remember having in 2 Commando, Jimmy Ogden, grade 8 education, warrant officer. Yeah. He had guys with degrees, privates, troopers in his company,
yeah,
in the commando, I should say. And you see that a lot today now. But everybody's getting the education. So the thick, dumb infantiers, they're gone.
Yeah.
They wouldn't survive.
Yeah.
There's too much as far as, there's too many things that go bump in the night on the battlefield nowadays. You can't be a fool.
There's a lot of technology right now too.
That's what that's what I'm trying to allude to. Yeah. That you can't be a thud on the ground anymore. You will not survive. But that's what ended up. That's what happened to me. Is time to move on.
Yeah. What did you do after the military career? Did you pick any like trades up, or did you stay with medical at all, or?
No, because of the PTSD thing, I had to quit a job. I used to work in an emergency in the Royal Jubilee Hospital.
Mm-hmm.
I used to work as a CAS tech there. It was a good gig, $25 an hour, kind of like that.
Yeah.
But too many medical things as far as, again, it's part of the PTSD, the stress thing. It just didn't work out.
Mm-hmm.
But the one thing that did work out is I do like to do a little woodworking, so I've been making pins.
Yep.
So I've been built a library, do some woodworking things for your friends here and there, and the odd person on the phone. But primarily, I make pins.
Yep.
I'm a pen maker now, and I'm actually quite happy to do it.
Uh-huh.
I've been laid up for about the last year because of my neck, going through various treatments for that. But expect to be getting back on it here pretty soon.
It's mm-hmm. good to hear. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, I think that's about covers all. I want to thank you very much for letting me come over your house and
by all means
grill you for a little while. Yeah, I appreciate it.
Short, sweet, to the point.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.